Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to a new episode of the Sports Mecca podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Abramo. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Sam Hengeli. Tonight, we are joined by college basketball bracketologist and blogger, Graham Doran, to discuss brackets for the upcoming 2024 NCAA tournament field. Graham, thank you so much for coming on the podcast for a third consecutive year.
Yeah, happy to be here. And you guys know this. This is my favorite time of year. So really excited to see what the March Madness has in store for us this year.
Yeah. And, you know, I know that you're very excited. So I am curious, and for our listeners, how many brackets have you put together this season in anticipation for the selection show, which is 2 weeks from now?
Oh man, I don't know the answer to that. If I had a guess, it's probably somewhere around 40, but that's just brackets. That doesn't include, seed lists and all that sort of stuff either. But I've been putting together brackets since I'd say December at the latest. It's been a long, long time, which is interesting because you see these teams develop throughout the course of the year, and you kind of start to understand the teams a little bit more when you see the way their seeds go up and down. And I think that's something that some people that only follow college basketball in March miss out on, is like, what led this team to be where they are in the bracket? Because not every story is the same. And I think that's something the committee really tries to understand, is who exactly is this team? Because no team is going to have the same exact resume as another, even ones that end up on the same seed line. So that's the real big challenge for the selection committee, is determining what makes one team equal to another when their seasons are so very different.
Yeah. For you, when you put the different brackets together and then you seed teams throughout the year, whether they're going up or down, what are your big evaluators in seeding teams and including them in a projected NCAA tournament field?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I start with is I start with the metrics. So that includes your net rating, but also your KPI resume ranking, your strength of record, which is another resume ranking, as well as some other efficiency metrics like KenPom, and also looking at BPI, which is through ESPN. And I start with those metrics to get an idea of where this team belongs in the field. So for example, if you had a team like Kansas, you would say, okay, well, they're seventh in strength of record and they're eighth in KPI. Okay, maybe their efficiency is not quite as good. So maybe they're kind of hoping to be a two seed, but maybe a three seed. That's the metrics will kind of give you an idea of what a team might look like. but sometimes those metrics can be vastly different. So, for example, St. Mary's has a resume metric average of 51.5, yet they have a top 20 net ranking. So you see a team like that, you're like, what do you do with that team? And even sorting the teams into a possible position in the bracket becomes really, really challenging when you have teams with metrics that are that vastly different. So I kind of start with the metrics to get a baseline of where in the bracket a team might be. And then from there, I'm just comparing really head to head. I'm looking, should this one team be above this team? Should that team be above this team? And just comparing resumes. And one of the big factors in comparing resumes is not just looking at how did one team do against one quadrant versus how did another team do against that same quadrant, but it's looking at the actual teams. So sometimes, you know, it's kind of a simplistic view of bracketology. I think we hear this a lot. You'll have fans that say, well, this team is XYZ in quad one, and this team is XYZ in quad one. So shouldn't this team be ahead? And the answer is no, because there's so much more to it. You're looking at the quality of the team played. So, you know, you could get Villanova at home, could be a net quad one win, but at Houston could be a net quad one win. The committee would not look at these games even remotely similar. They are vastly different in how difficult it is to win those games. So for me, road wins carry a lot of weight because the committee values those. But also it's within those quadrants, how really truly strong is a win? Because it's not just about the numbers. The numbers help get you a picture of where a team might be, but it really goes beyond that into a more thorough evaluation of each and every game.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, currently, your latest bracket that you put together earlier this week on Tuesday, you have Houston, UConn, Tennessee, and Purdue as your one seeds. Is there any way any of those teams in that group fall off the top seed line?
I think Purdue, Houston, and UConn are totally set to go as one seeds. The only possible thing I could see happening there is if there ended up being a key injury to a best player on any of those teams, then maybe we could have to look at how they do in their final couple of games. But without that, I think the only way that there's a change on the one line is if Tennessee were to lose. I think Tennessee controls their own destiny for a one seed. But if they don't end up winning the SEC tournament, winning out until then, Tennessee would be in danger of falling off the one line.
You think it's Tennessee battling with Arizona?
And I would also throw North Carolina in there as a strong contender, and I wouldn't rule out any of Iowa State, Baylor, Marquette, or Kansas, and maybe not even Duke. Probably Duke is done, but I wouldn't say 100% sure they're done, because they do get an opportunity against North Carolina at home, and if they were to win out through that ACC tournament, I think there's an outside shot that Duke could potentially land there if there was disaster for some other teams ahead of them. But that would be a very, very slim shot for Duke.
Which teams the past 2 or 3 weeks that you've been paying attention to have really improved their seeding, and teams that have drastically fallen off the map and could potentially miss the 68 team field?
I have Gonzaga as a team that has absolutely flown up the bracket and very quickly. Part of the thing that happens to mid-majors is it's a high risk, high reward when they play difficult games. Gonzaga went to Kentucky and then they went to St. Mary's. They won both of those. They went from a team that was outside of my field to now a six seed. Had they lost both of those games, their at-large case would be totally done right now. But because they won them both, they are locked for the NCAA tournament and a good seed. On the other hand, Wisconsin is a team that just cannot seem to win games now. They were a solid team and on the four line at the bracket reveal just a couple of weeks ago. But now I see Wisconsin kind of bordering that 6-7 seed range. So a very disappointing end to the year for the Badgers.
Yeah, on your most recent bracket as well, you have Michigan State as a 10. What is their standing? Are they also a team that could be on the verge of missing the tournament as they continue to slide?
Yeah, I think they could miss the tournament. That said, I think they're probably going to make it. That home win over Northwestern was huge. Not only is it a win against a team in the field, but more importantly, it sets them apart from having one of those records that the committee doesn't want to see. And that would just be having too many losses versus not enough wins. Sometimes I think that's a thing some bracketologists underrate, is they don't pay enough attention to the overall record of a team because they're getting too caught up in who did they play, what was their quadrant splits. But sometimes you just look up and you're like, this team is 17-14. The committee is not going to take a team that's 17-14 unless they have the best wins ever. But a lot of bracketologists are so deep into the resume and the way that those games are split up, they don't really think a whole lot about overall record. As odd as that is to say, because the casual fan would never forget to look at a team's overall record. But bracketologists, it's actually kind of like the last thing we often look at. But I do think overall record is more important than most bracketologists think. And that's why I think Michigan State, had they lost to Northwestern, would have been in real trouble. They just wouldn't have enough victories. But adding that quality win against Northwestern at home, not a terrific win by any means, but it is a solid win. And I think that will probably be enough to get Michigan State into the tournament.
Let's say Michigan State falls in their season finale and then they go out first round. Their very first game of the Big Ten tournament, that they'd still be potentially in that maybe first four game?
I think it would be really close to whether they're in the bracket or not, and I agree they could potentially be in that first four game. I think Michigan State's the challenge with projecting out even a couple games out is we don't know what every other team in the country is doing. So if a lot of bubble teams win games, all of a sudden Michigan State's in serious trouble. If all the other bubble teams also lose two straight, then Michigan State's looking really good because they're already on that 10 line. They already have a cushion compared to some of those other teams. So that's what makes projecting that way really difficult, is there are so many other things that could happen around a team that we just don't know how that's going to look.
So Rick Pitino is in his first year at St. John's and his team is currently on the bubble. What has to happen for them to make the NCAA tournament?
Well, they're in a really interesting position because they need Villanova to win and become a tournament team so that those wins that they have against Villanova look better. At the same time, they're competing with Villanova for a spot in the NCAA tournament. So I think what St. John's is ultimately going to have to do is they're going to have to win their last regular season game, but I also think they're going to have to win a game at Madison Square Garden in the Big East tournament. I don't think that would lock them into the field, but I think that's probably going to be the situation for St. John's. If they win their next two, I think they're probably going to the tournament. If they don't win their next two, I think their bubble's probably going to get popped, but it's going to be close either way.
So Kansas was the number one team in the preseason, but has struggled throughout a Big 12 play. Currently a three seed right now in your bracketology and many others. Are they locked as a three, or could they move up to a two or even drop down to a four? And what are the chances of them getting in the Midwest?
I think they could possibly drop to a four if they lose to both Houston and their first game of the Big 12 tournament. But I think there's a huge gap between Kansas and the four seeds. And let me give you an example. You're looking over at Alabama, a team that's won three games against Quadrant One. Kansas has three wins against number one seeds. That's the kind of gap we're talking about right now. So I think Kansas has way too many quality wins to reasonably drop to a four. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think they're pretty well set for a top three seed just based on the Tennessee neutral court win, the Kentucky neutral court win, and then, of course, those wins over Houston and UConn at home. But considering where the Jayhawks are right now, I would say they're closer to that 2 line than the 4 line. And I wouldn't even rule out a 1 seed, as crazy as that is. They've got opportunity because they go to Houston. If you win at Houston and then you end up getting only a single bye in the Big 12 tournament versus the double bye, that's a chance to add 4 wins in Kansas City. And if they add 4 wins in Kansas City against the Big 12, they're talking about 3 really good wins being a part of that. If Kansas, let's put it a different way. Houston is a lock for a 1 seed. UConn is a lock for a 1 seed. Tennessee is looking good for a 1 seed. If Kansas were to win at Houston, they would be 4-0 against number 1 seeds entering the Big 12 tournament. And if they were to win the Big 12 tournament, they'd probably be doing it by beating Houston again. If a team is 3-0 against a number 1 seed and 2-0 against other number 1 seeds, how do you possibly tell a team that is 5-0 against number 1 seeds that they're not good enough to be there? So do I think that's going to happen? No. Frankly, I think the Jayhawks aren't going to have much of a chance at Houston, and that's going to end that conversation immediately. But that's the sort of opportunity that's still ahead of Kansas. They have the chance to add some really good wins. So I think the real question for the Jayhawks is whether they're going to be a 2 or a 3 seed. And I think that's going to come down to how they do in Kansas City, because Iowa State and Baylor are in that same boat of looking like possible 2 seeds, possible 3 seeds. I think those 3 are going to sort out who's a 2 seed and who's a 3 seed at the Big 12 tournament.
And what are the chances of them getting in the Midwest?
I think it will come down to whether they're that 2 seed or the 3 seed. If they're the 2 seed, it's unlikely that they would be in the Midwest. And I say that because I'm thinking it's most likely that you're going to have a team like North Carolina or Duke, the winner of that game this weekend and potentially an ACC tournament winner, going to the Midwest, as odd as it is to say. Detroit is closer to them than some of these other sites around there. So you don't really think of a team from North Carolina going to the Midwest as their closest regional, but that is their closest regional since Boston is the host of the East Regional this year and Dallas is the host of the South Regional. So there's going to be a lot of teams who want to be in that Midwest region. So I think it's unlikely Kansas would be there if they're a 2 seed, but if they were a 3 seed, I think there's a very good chance they could be there. Because you'd be potentially looking at a team, again, like North Carolina or Duke that would be there as a 2 seed. And then you could have the Jayhawks not being with Purdue in the Big Ten, not being with one of those ACC teams. So, and maybe even if it's Marquette as the 2 seed, they, we would be looking for balance on having teams from different conferences in the Midwest. So Kansas could potentially be that first Big 12 team to settle into the Midwest.
With your current bracket, which bracket or which region in your bracket could you see completely breaking?
Well, I think the difficult part is even when you predict one of these brackets, so much can change before Selection Sunday. And even on the Selection Sunday bracket, all you need is a couple teams that you're off on and your projection of who goes to which region changes completely. But I would always give the same answer pretty much every year. The West region is almost always the region that can break the craziest. And the reason why is pretty much every year, the West region ends up with the weakest number 1 seed. And the reason why is because most of your best basketball teams in America are in the Midwest and the East Coast, and they prefer to play closer to home. So that's why those regions tend to break, is because they tend to get the teams who are lowest seeded on their seed line headed out to the West region, and that makes the top teams more vulnerable to upset.
Yeah, the West region, that was like, the last year's West region was not like that at all.
I've never seen a more loaded region in my entire life, and the fact that the committee put that together was really shocking to me.
So that follows up to this next question I have. Last year, we saw Chris Reynolds and the tournament committee put up an abomination with last year's bracket, where he had like all the top teams in one region, and then like pretty much be unbalanced, which ended up leading to like a Final Four with the highest seed as the 4 seed. How concerned are you that they'll completely bonk again on this bracket?
It's interesting. I feel like I learn more and more every year. And yet, no matter what I learn, I'm always surprised by something. And this year, I was surprised at the bracket reveal that the committee had North Carolina as their top two seed, because I don't think they had the wins to earn that. And then they also had San Diego State as their 14th overall seed, and I didn't think they had the wins to earn that either. So for me, you never know what you're going to get with a committee. One thing that's kind of difficult as a bracketologist to accept is that we've done this for years and years and years, and a lot of the people on the committee, it's their first year, ever year. They've never put together a bracket before. They're learning. They are learning how to do this, and we are people that have all this experience. So sometimes they'll put together these seeds that you're like, that doesn't make a ton of sense. And honestly, it probably just comes down to some people voted in a way that if they had been doing this for 15 or 20 years, they probably wouldn't have voted that way.
Yeah, and I was thinking about last year when they interviewed Chris Reynolds after they put Houston in the Midwest and KU and West, and he ended up KU had 15 quad one wins, and then all of a sudden, like, somehow quad two wins became actually mattered. And then it was just like,
really? Yeah. And actually you're even confusing the number there. It was 15 and two in quads one and two for Houston, but Kansas had 17 wins against quadrant one. 17. That is absolutely absurd. And there was talk of, well, Kansas lost to Texas. Well, Memphis beat Houston by 20. So if we want to get into the conversation of what happened in the tournament final, I think that was, for me, that was, and a lot of other bracketologists that I've spoken to, it's not just me, that was a really, really infuriating thing to see the selection committee do, because you can't possibly earn your bracket placement more than winning 17 quad one wins. It's almost like they speculated, how would Houston have looked if they played Kansas's schedule? Well, we know how Kansas looked, and they won 17 games against quadrant one, and Houston lost at home to Temple. That's all that should really need to be said there.
So my last question is, looking at the current bracket, who are your top three teams that you see that can win the NCAA championship this year?
Well, there's two teams that I've been pretty steady since the beginning of the season on really thinking they're national championship quality teams, and that's UConn number one and UNC number two in that order. I haven't really strayed from that opinion the entire season. What has caught my attention is how steady Purdue has been, and I think if there's a third team to throw in there, I would throw Purdue in there. Obviously, you've got a lot of really good teams out there like Houston and Tennessee and Arizona. But Purdue looks like they could potentially be doing that Virginia 2019 thing where they come back and say, hey, we are 100% focused this tournament. What I will say about that Virginia team, though, is people forget they were screwed on three different occasions. Against Purdue, they needed to miss a free throw, get the rebound, and hit a two-pointer at the buzzer in order to send that game to overtime. And they had a lane violation on the free throw by the shooter, and the officials didn't notice it. Had they noticed that, championship season's over. Then against Auburn, they need a foul call on a three-pointer, again, right at the buzzer. And if they don't get that foul call, season's over. Texas Tech, if they have really any number of things go differently, Texas Tech wins that game. If Texas Tech just guards the three-point line and lets Virginia go in for a two-pointer, the season's over. So I think Purdue's looking like a team that could do that, but that's just a reminder. Even for a team that had that 100% turnaround, it still takes a lot to win a national championship. The years where a UConn goes through and destroys everybody are really, really rare. It just takes a lot of luck, and I think Purdue, having the experience they have, could be that sort of Virginia team that survives close scares along the way.
And think about UConn. No team since 2007, the Florida Gators that went back-to-back, have gotten past the Sweet 16. So all the defending national champs that have not made it farther than the Sweet 16 since 2007. So if there's one thing I'd be a little bit skeptical on UConn is just that the fact that the odds are not in their favor based on the defending national champs, but they still highly of them. And I could definitely see UNC making a run, especially I think RJ Davis, just the way he can take over a game. He's the type of guy who can like really string six great games together and carry you to a championship.
I completely agree with you. And I was talking to a friend who I do a podcast together with, Kerry Miller from Bleacher Report. And we talked about RJ Davis could be that Kemba Walker, Shabazz Napier type, the guy who carries his team to a national championship. Completely agree with you there. For UConn, I will say they are really good defensively and they are awesome offensively. And that is a dangerous combination for the tournament. Because even their bad games on offense, they're still good defensively. I think UConn, like I said, I think they're number one, and I'd say they are a strong number one, in my opinion, as far as who I think is most likely to win this tournament.
Graham, we obviously once again appreciate you coming on, but for people who will listen to this podcast, provide your website that you post all your latest brackets on throughout the week and how our listeners can follow you on social media and keep track of your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I post my bracket on grahamdoran.wordpress.com just to have it posted out there. But the reality is, if you actually want to keep up with everything, just follow me on Twitter at Graham Doran. That's GRAHAMDOERN. Because I'm on there all the time, and I am providing all of my brackets, all my seed lists, all my analysis on there. And also, if you want to go on YouTube and search the Unnamed Bracketology Podcast, like I mentioned, I do that podcast with the Bleacher Report's Kerry Miller, and we're moving to three times a week starting this week, because once you're this close to the tournament, it's time to give people every little update.
Yeah, absolutely. Is the selection show the second greatest day of the year for you?
No, it's the greatest day of the year.
I mean, hey, fair enough. Sim, I like it.
It's better than Christmas morning. You get to unwrap your present and see what's waiting for you.
Yeah.
Shout out Greg Gumbel.
Greg Gumbel, man. 73 years old. I hope he is doing it forever.
I can just hear him now. And out of the Midwest region, it's the number one seed.
Oh, man, that's great. You know, once again, Graham, we appreciate you coming on for a third straight year. And we hope that you can continue putting the brackets together up until Selection Sunday, which is only about 2 weeks away.
Looking forward to it, and have a good night, guys.